This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we're going to talk now with the co-author of a book which is actually a continuation of two previous editions of the book, which is entitled Gary, A Pictorial History. We have with us IU Northwest History Professor Emeritus James Lane, who, along with his co-author Ron Cohen, have been working on this book. And the latest edition of the book is the third edition. Can you believe this? It's hard to believe that they've had three editions of the book so far.
Well, it's great because it first came out in 1982. And then 20 years later, we had a chance to update it and add a chapter taking it up to date. And likewise, recently we had an opportunity, thanks to the Legacy Foundation and the City of Gary, our sponsors, to bring it right up to the year 2018.
For folks that are not familiar with this book, you can obviously check it out from the library. You can find it all around. You probably have extra copies at the Calumet Region Archives, don't you, and at the IU Northwest. But there may be people that would like to find copies of their own, have copies of their own. But for those who are not familiar with the book, give us an idea going from the very start of the book all the way to where we stand now in the 21st century.
Sure. Well, Gary was founded in 1906, but we have a chapter dealing with the sparsely settled area prior to that time and the coming of the railroads and the Etna gunpowder factory and Swedes moving to Miller and the Calumet Gun Club. Mm-hmm. And then really with U.S. Steel founding the city and buying up 7 or so miles of shoreline. We have pictures of the construction of the mill, but we tried to emphasize people in our pictorial history, the diversity of Gary, all the scores of ethnic groups that settled here from Central and Southern and Eastern Europe, and a lot of coal miners from Pennsylvania coming out here to work in the mills. And even going up to our final chapter, the 16 pages that are in color, we tried to basically argue against the stereotype that Gary's, you know, a virtual ghost town. So many people like to explore the so-called ruins of Gary, City Methodist and Union Station. That we wanted to show the variety of activities that the people of Gary are still involved with. You know, so we have photos of church services and school activities, people protesting the efforts by GEO to build an immigration detention center near the Gary Airport. Mm-hmm. The air show at Marquette Park, the people gathering every year at Michael Jackson's boyhood home, and that kind of stuff.
Now, how did the book actually get started, how the first edition came to be?
Well, the Donning Company specializes on, you might say, tabletop pictorial histories. There's one that the historian Lance Trusty did of Hammond. Archibald McKinley did one of East Chicago. And so we had the opportunity, if we could raise enough money to have it in print. And in those days, the Gary National Bank and the Post Tribune were our sponsors. And this last one, like I say, the Legacy Foundation, which has sponsored many local projects, and the City of Gary were our two main sponsors. So in other words, Donnie got their money up front, and the book came out, and now it's on sale at various places, the mm-hmm. IU Northwest Bookstore, Lake Street Gallery in Miller, and at City Hall are the main three places where people can get it. In fact, the Gary Public Library had a celebration and book signing last Friday, and we were able to thank our sponsors. And I was telling somebody from the Legacy Foundation that some of the photos in here, such as the DK Devils refurbishing Union Station and the Calumet Artist Residency projects that involve a lot of young kids, a lot of projects that the Legacy Foundation itself has sponsored, found photos of those activities in our book.
When you got the things together to be able to put the first edition out, were most of these items, the photos, of course, in particular, and then, of course, descriptions that you had to link in captions to the photos, had they come from the Calumet Region Archives, the one that you helped curate at IU Northwest?
Yes, most of them did, and some of them came from the archives of the Post Tribune. But as you mentioned, I'm co-director, along with Ron Cohen, of the Calumet Regional Archives at IU Northwest, which the two of us founded. And we have over 500 collections, so a lot of the photos are in there. We also wanted to we consulted some of the nationality clubs and people we knew that were connected with, say, Romanian or Slovak or other ethnic groups in order to have that full diversity in there. And this past edition, we leaned very heavily on professional photographs that, say, Times reporters for the newspaper took, and other Guy Rhodes is a professional photographer and an East Chicago Central grad.
Yeah, in fact, we've had him on the program talking about his photos and the work he does.
Oh, he did this great photo of the air show where he's in one of these planes, you know, flying above the crowd at Marquette Park. It was, in fact, you know, the first edition, it was pretty easy to find historical photographs of the early days in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. And it became harder as we took the, made the, you know, took it up to the present. And so the newspaper photographers have really been a help throughout all three editions.
I can imagine. In the first part of the book, you get a lot of great photos, historic photos, particularly of neighborhoods in Gary and particularly of downtown Gary.
Yeah.
People today, in looking at the book, would probably shake their head. They would not believe how downtown Gary looked. But it's not being exaggerating. It was a very, very vibrant downtown, probably as vibrant or maybe in some cases more so than some other communities, not only in our region, but probably the rest of the Midwest.
Yeah, in the 1920s, which I call Gary's Augustan Age, many of the buildings that still remain, the KFC building, the bank building, the city hall, were built in the 1920s. And so that was sort of one heyday prior to the coming of the Great Depression. And then the World War II period was, you might say, a second heyday with war industries employing so many people that you had an in-migration of Southern whites and African Americans and a housing shortage where people lived as, you know, as far away as Cedar Lake, where a bus three times a day would bring them to work. In the 1920s, there was a streetcar system that linked the whole region, and people, you know, it was a commercial hub for the region, and people could get on a streetcar and, you know, and shop in Gary and go to the Palace Theater or one of the other dozen theaters in Gary and spend the day shopping at the various department stores, Goldblatt's and others that people still remember, the aroma of roasted nuts as they would walk in the back of Goldblatt's.
Mm-hmm. The book features lots and lots of photos, and besides the ones that you might expect in a book like this, with a lot of photos of steel making activities and the like, and of people who work at the steel mills. But you mentioned, and you said you went to the many groups that had various activities, whether it was a fraternal or whether it was a social activity of some sort, and lots of pictures of people. And as you mentioned, that's an interesting part of the book, I think, is the fact that it is very people-oriented. A lot of architecture, as we say, all these great photos of downtown Gary in its heydays, both of them, as you mentioned, but also, too, a lot of people that are participating in activities, even going back into the 20s and the 30s. And you say during wartime, when people were busy working for the war effort, but they still had time to have fun and they had time to get together and socialize if need be.
And like the Palace Theater, sat, seated almost 3,000 people, and they would, and you still talk to people in their 60s and 70s that remember going to the movies Saturday morning, and then going off to get something to eat, and like I say, spending the day in Gary, and we were cognizant of wanting to do that. And in addition to the other sources I mentioned, Facebook and other various social media are good sources of photographs as well. You have to make sure you get permission, but there were two photos that I think are among my favorites. We have a page devoted to religious services. Mm-hmm. And so one of the photos taken by a professional photographer is the Wirt Emerson Choir singing at Holy Angels for Easter services, I think it was. And of course, Wirt Emerson is no longer in existence. And Holy Angels is still there, but doesn't have the attendance it once was. But then we have another photograph, again a very professional one of Saint Timothy, and a Vesper service that Billy Foster, the great jazz pianist, who's a member of that church, composed. And we didn't think we might. I wanted a third photo that made it in. Fortunately, I was never quite sure whether the person putting the book together would follow my instructions. But we have a third picture of Trinity Baptist Church and the Reverend Dwight Gardner, and that church is also 100 years old. And Dwight Gardner is as an example of somebody that was a head of physical plant at IU Northwest who had a calling and went out and is a pastor now. And you find, Gary is honeycombed with these churches that become community centers and hold neighborhoods together. There's a church, a progressive community church, right down where Emerson School used to be, where they're starting urban gardens. And so a lot of things are emanating from those churches. And not just the big traditional ones.
I know we don't have a lot of time left in the conversation for today, but we'd be remiss if we didn't mention about the big physical and psychological and political changes that happened in the city of Gary over the years, particularly in the 50s into the 60s and even as late as the 1970s. And the book does a very good job, I think, of outlining a lot of these events by pictures, showing political candidates and particularly historical political candidates in their visits to Gary and people coming by and trying to campaign to get the civil rights movement going.
Yeah, one of the final photos in the book shows the present mayor, Karen Freeman Wilson, with former mayor Richard Hatcher in his 80s. It was taken in 2016 as they were promoting an upcoming national political convention or an event honoring the famous one that took place at Westside in 1972. And both of those people, Mayor Hatcher and Freeman Wilson, they could have gone anywhere and made a ton of money. Hatcher was an internationally known person, head of Trans Africa, et cetera, et cetera. But they've chose, like a lot of other people, to remain in Gary and try to keep their city vibrant. And Hatcher, I mentioned this in a recent Steel Shavings magazine that I put out. At a time during the 1960s when many civil rights contemporaries of his were losing faith in the political system as riots went on and assassinations of our leaders like Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, he kept faith in playing within the system. And really dedicated his life, I think, to trying to promote other young black people into going into public service, including his daughter, of course.
Well, Professor Lane, we're out of time for this conversation, but we'll have to get you back in here again. We could probably just go through the entire book and break it down by segment and talk about it too. But once again, the third edition of the book, which is entitled Gary, A Pictorial History, that is published. The authors are one of our guests here today, Professor Emeritus James Lane and Ronald Cohen. They have put together an updated book right up to this year, as a matter of fact, here. And you can find out more by going online, find out about the book, where it's available, and all some of the places here in Northwest Indiana that you can pick up copies of the book. And we certainly thank you for spending time with us to talk about this, and we will have another conversation again to break out some of these other specific dates and eras of the city of Gary, how it's grown and how it's changed and managed to stay alive, despite what many people have thought would not happen.
It'll be my pleasure, and thanks for having me today.
Oh, you're welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. There's been something actually in the Indiana statutes for years about what constitutes bias, but there really hasn't been a lot that maybe are giving prosecutors a bit more of tools to be able to offer any greater sanction on any offenders that may be accused of bias. But there is a bill that has been filed that will come up in the upcoming General Assembly session from our next guest and a co-sponsor as well, that will take the hate crime measure one step further. And we have with us Senator Mike Bohacek from Michiana Shores. And thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, thanks a lot. I appreciate the opportunity.
You and your colleague, Senator Ron Alting from Lafayette, have proposed what is right now listed as Senate Bill 12, which will go into great detail on some additions that will be made to Indiana criminal law for prosecutors and for judges to take a look at when it comes time to deal with a particular case. If you will, first tell us what you feel are the most important additions that the measure that you and your colleague are offering up for lawmakers to consider this session.
Sure. Certainly, what we did is, and I know, unfortunately, this is always called hate crimes, and it's really not. This is true bias crimes legislation. And as you look at the legislation, it makes sure that everybody, regardless of whatever characteristics they have, are protected. But it happens at time of sentencing. So as opposed to creating a new group of laws, this gives our judges the opportunity, and I trust the subject matter experts, which is our elected judiciary, to, at time of sentencing, use a sentencing aggravator. So let me give you an example. So if you were convicted of battery, and that's a level 6 felony, there's an advisory prison sentence. The judges can go on the lesser side via mitigators or on the more aggressive side versus aggravators. This bias crimes legislation at time of sentencing provides our judiciary the ability, if they see fit, to be able to aggravate the sentence. What's nice about this, or, I mean, none of this is nice, but the flexible part of this is that even in the case of a plea agreement, so if a level 5 felony is pled down to a 6, the judges can still utilize this aggravator at time of sentencing. So we're hoping it's going to be a deterrent, but if not, it allows the judiciary to sentence as they see best fit.
A bit more flexibility than perhaps what the current statutes call for, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Are there any points in particular, and I know that the additions that are put into the law, which is stated in the bill, talk about specific situations or incidents that perhaps, if you want to call them that, that might be considered more as bias indicators here. What are these points that maybe are not in the measure now that will perhaps make this measure more attractive when the lawmakers have to take a look at it when session starts?
Certainly, yeah. When I had co-authored a bill last year, the scope was very, very narrow. There was, I think there was about 8 different categories of bias. But Senator Alton and myself realized that bias is bigger than that. And in listening to a debate during committee and other conversations, we realized that we needed to have maybe a little bit a bigger scope, but then also make sure that as times change, the legislation can also grow with our community, which the last qualifier also protects bias in any other identifiable group, and I think you'll see that in the bill. Mm-hmm. So as, you know, times change, this would allow the bill to be dynamic and not have to continue to be readdressed over and over again. And once again, gives our judiciary, who are our elected judges, to utilize this the statute as they see fit. So I think it's a real, probably the biggest part of this, or the biggest attribute of the bill, is the flexibility that we have now that previous legislation attempts did not have.
Does the measure that you and Senator Alding are proposing not necessarily focus more on, but have bring up maybe more prominently the issue of concerns about bias and discrimination against gays and lesbians and transgender and bisexual people?
Gender identity, mm-hmm. is in the bill, whether it's perceived or actual. Sexual identity is there, whether it's perceived or actual. We also, have many other specifically protected classes, and then also some broad language that would also address situations that potentially were missed. Mm-hmm. So, it's a very very broad reaching piece of legislation.
More so than what the current statute has, apparently, right?
Well, the current statute is a Supreme Court opinion. So some say that our judges can already do this. There's some debate about that as far as the ease of being able to utilize bias as an aggravator. And Senator Alton and myself believe that the best way to let our judiciary handle this is with specific statutorial language, and thus Senate Bill 12.
Were there any examples or incidents or other information that's come forth here in the meantime that you and Senator Alding have taken a look at to bring up the issue of I guess, bias, certainly in this case here, as some would call them hate crimes, that maybe is what prompted you, besides wanting to beef up and make this bill a bit more comprehensive than last time?
You know, we get asked that question all the time. You know, what specifically triggered you to author this legislation? Senator Alton and I, have the same conversation. We just feel that it's time. It's been time for many, many years. We can talk about the young man that was accosted in Chicago just 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. We can talk about synagogue vandalism. We can talk about any number of issues. We can talk about the young man in North Central Indiana who was victimized due to bias. You know, when you're authoring legislation, you hope that it's not due to single issues, but more importantly, it's an overreaching effort to resolve something that's just not addressed and it's not right.
Mm-hmm. I know there's also one other question that's come up here and has been asked before, and you probably had to answer before, too, about what kind of economic impact, if there is any, that if this bill passes and it becomes law as the session goes on, would benefit Indiana perhaps more so, since Indiana, and it's been published before and mentioned before about the fact that Indiana is only one of five states that does have a quote-unquote hate crimes bill.
Right. And we've talked about this too. Many of the chambers of commerce support this. Our public universities support this. Many in our business community support this. And you're absolutely right. Part of this is also an economic bill. As companies look to relocate to a state, they look for specific protections, and they look for legislative things. That are going to benefit their business. Now, Indiana does an exceptional job of attracting new businesses. But on the social side, I think we've kind of missed a little bit. And I think it's probably cost us some higher-end tech opportunities because we just, we just don't have these protections. So, and you're absolutely right, we need to look at this a little bit more beyond the criminal side and also onto the economic development side to be able to attract great talent from other states and also great opportunities. So you're absolutely correct. It's a bigger issue than just the criminal side.
Now, let me ask the question. I know you're optimistic about this. You have to be optimistic about the bills that you either introduce on your own or you introduce with your colleagues in the Indiana Senate. Do you think that the way this measure has been written, and maybe you've gotten some indication from your colleagues also ahead of time, that this measure may have some chance of passage this time?
during the session, especially this early on, because the session doesn't start until January, I'm cautiously optimistic, but we're working to educate our colleagues and on both sides of the aisle, because there's resistance on the Democrat side too. Some folks think this doesn't go far enough, trying to get some consensus. Now, both myself and Senator Alteen, we're cautiously optimistic. We're working very hard to gain consensus and to address the issues that that our colleagues may have on both sides of the aisle, to see if we can get something that's workable, that will pass quickly. We've been working on this for 3 years. So, the saying at the State House is great legislation typically takes 3 sessions. Bad legislation takes 1. And I think after 3+ years of vetting this, I think we have a good piece of legislation.
Well, Senator Blachek, thank you for spending time with us to talk about this, and we'll keep our fingers crossed and see what your colleagues on the floor of the Senate and over in the House, because they'll have to take a look at it, too, if it gets out of the Senate before it goes on, if it's passed by both houses, to go on to the governor for his review. Thank you for spending time with us to talk about this, and as always, we hope that this next session goes well for you and your colleagues at the State House.
Thanks a lot.
We've been talking with Indiana State Senator Mike Blachek. He's a Republican from Michiana Shores, and he and his colleague Senator Ron Alting from Lafayette are producing a measure which deals with the question of bias, making some changes that perhaps lawmakers and judges will best be able to use when they take up these cases when they come before them. An increasing number of cities and states are adopting regulations for the sale and the planting of bamboo. Certain types are actually considered invasive. They can quickly spread to many, many properties. But there's nothing to stop Hoosiers from planting bamboo these days. Let's find out more from Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier.
Brandy Hosts lives in the middle of Bloomington.
That's Laverne. She's the last of the living chickens.
But you'd never know once you step into her backyard. It's lined with a dense patch of green bamboo. Many of the stalks are at least twice her height and provide a natural fence around the property.
I think it's a really good sound insulator, too. I don't hear anybody back here. It's mostly residential.
Host loves the privacy the bamboo provides, but she wasn't prepared for the maintenance it would require when she bought the house a few years ago.
The previous homeowner's wife said to me at the closing, asked me if I owned a truck, and I said I didn't, and she giggled. She was like, well, good luck, because she knew.
Host has to clear a large portion of the bamboo once a year, and it takes 2 truckloads to haul away.
Stopping it is next to impossible without major excavation work, and so what I'm trying to do is just maintain and control it more than anything.
And that's not easy. Just ask Dave Seastrom.
As soon as I got it in the ground, I started realizing what a tremendously invasive plant this is.
He planted a patch of bamboo on his secluded Unionville property about 20 years ago. Seastrom likes that the shoots provide shelter for wildlife and also dries them out to use for various projects. But keeping the plant from overtaking his yard is a lot of work. Seastrom dug a trench around his bamboo and installed a plastic barrier to keep it from spreading.
As long as I'm here, I think this is contained, but I'm very concerned about the reality that one day I won't be here. And it would be tremendously irresponsible if this bamboo got loose in the forest.
Yellow groove bamboo is the type you'll see most often planted in yards across Indiana. And what's so tricky is that it's a type of running bamboo. That means its underground rhizomes travel horizontally and then send up new shoots. Ellen Jacquart is chair of Monroe County Identify and Reduce Invasive Species. She says traditional barriers like fences won't stop this bamboo.
So when you're planting something like yellow groove bamboo, that's one of the running bamboos, you're not planting it in your yard, you're planting it in the county, because it will not stop at your boundary. It will head on to your neighbors and on to their neighbors.
That can lead to disputes between neighbors and even cause property damage. So some other states and cities have adopted regulations for bamboo planting. There aren't any in Indiana, but Jacquart says the state's Natural Resources Commission did preliminarily adopt a measure earlier this year that would make it illegal to sell, transport, or distribute more than 40 invasive plants in the state.
While bamboo isn't on it, I think that in the future, we're going to be looking at evaluating it and seeing if we can add that to the highly invasive list for Indiana.
Until that happens, the only option for Hoosiers is to battle unwanted bamboo themselves. Seastrom says while he enjoys the bamboo in his yard, he now realizes it was probably irresponsible to plant.
And my wife has been bugging me to take the leap and eradicate this patch. So that's probably next on the agenda.
Just how much work that will take is something he tries not to think about. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
The Indiana Supreme Court has ruled local governments can no longer fine railroad companies for stopping on tracks, regardless of how long a train may block a crossing. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Charlotte Tuggle says that business practices on both sides of the argument have become central to the conversation.
The state's highest court ruled a long-standing Indiana statute was regulating the railroad business. That's banned by a federal law, the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act, or ICTA. Solicitor General Thomas Fisher says the state believes ICTA applies only to economic regulations.
This is an area where, given the local safety considerations and the local traffic control considerations, it plainly falls within the ambit of a traditional area of state regulation.
The Indiana Supreme Court disagreed. The justices saw ICTA as having a broader scope and that the enforcement of the state statute would, in Chief Justice Loretta Rush's words, substantially interfere with railroad operations. So Fisher says it's up to the federal government.
A law that doesn't directly govern trains, but that protects public safety more generally, and a train happens to be involved, that's still an area where a state law can provide some relief. But trying to regulate trains directly, unfortunately, is not something that states are going to have any success doing.
Norfolk Southern contends that to follow the blocked crossing rule, the company may have to shorten or speed up trains. In an emailed statement, a company spokesperson says the railroad is, quote, very cognizant of the inconveniences that can result if a train is stopped too long. But the note also says the court's decision won't affect current work with local communities to resolve those issues, where they note Norfolk Southern employees live and work. Communities such as Frankfort, for example. Railroads are ingrained in the city's history, so much so that it named a new, much-publicized downtown housing project Nickel Plate Flats in honor of the old Nickel Plate Rail Line. But despite the rich rail history in Frankfort, Mayor Chris McBarnes says trains are one of his biggest problems.
You know, we're cut in half north and south on a daily basis when it comes to our rail. We have a hospital on one side, we have a retirement home on the other. We have fire stations on one side, we have residences on the other. We have police officers that get blocked and aren't able to make it to a call or backup officers.
That crossing is just west of a Norfolk Southern rail yard, and McBarnes says its location affects more than simply traffic.
It being so close to our industrial park and so close to the downtown, it has a negative impact on public safety and economic development, along with citizen convenience.
One of the big drivers of economic development in Frankfort is NHK Seating of America. The company makes car seats, which it sends to the large Subaru plant just up the road in Lafayette. NHK has two plants on one side of the tracks, its main facility on the other.
So when the railroad tracks are blocked, it can literally shut my production line down, usually within 20 to 30 minutes.
That's plant manager Richard Reck.
And it does happen on occasion, more often than we'd like to see.
So if drivers can't go through the crossing, maybe they could go over it. Or at least that's what Mayor McBarnes is hoping for.
The overpass itself would swing out a little further to the east.
He's talking about the local tracks program. It's a matching grant fund through the Indiana Department of Transportation designed to reduce the number of at-grade highway rail crossings and enhance safety at others. It's very competitive. NDOT received 28 applications, totaling about $370 million in requests. That's nearly three times what the state can award at the end of November. McBarnes hopes Frankfort's situation stands out. Norfolk Southern is also working with NDOT on the local tracks grant program, and while ripples of the Supreme Court's decision are felt around the Hoosier state, blocked crossings are holding up drivers all around the Midwest.
New at 6, trouble on the tracks. Trains blocking railroad crossings in Ashtabula County.
A growing problem in Metro Detroit that's raising new safety concerns.
And now 5 on Your Side learns it is also happening in Highland.
But until the federal government decides to weigh in, which isn't a given, rural communities will search anywhere they can for a light at the end of the tunnel. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Charlotte Tuggle.
It's time once again for another edition of Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane.
For this edition of Eye on the Arts is Rob Commandera, who is board president at Footlight Theater in Michigan City, and he's also directing their current holiday production. Everybody's doing a holiday production of
some
kind.
Yes, they are.
Well, you have to make money while the sun shines,
right.
Or hay while the sun shines, which transfers into money. That's the saying. Okay. So, Rob, how long have you been involved with Footlight?
Oh, I've been involved with them for about 20, maybe 25 years. Mm-hmm. I've been president for 18 of those years. This is my 18th
goodness.
Term.
Yeah.
So I've been around for a while.
Yeah. And how long has Footlight been around?
Footlight, this is our 69th season.
Wow.
That we're starting. We started this year in August.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic.
Yep.
How many shows do you do a year typically?
Between five or six. This season we're only doing five. We're taking, after December, we're not doing another show again until March and then May. Mm-hmm. So we have two more shows after our Christmas show.
And it's all volunteer.
Yes, all volunteer. Nobody gets paid anything.
That's so sad, isn't it?
I know.
That's why they call it not my profit.
Well, like as a president, you have to clean the theater. I mean, that's, you know, it's a glorious job. It's like, I wish somebody could come and clean my house.
That's great. So you have, you're premiering this year. It's a new show.
It's a brand new show by the playwrights Hope Jones and Wooten. We've done about maybe seven or eight of their shows before, sold out. They're very, very comical writers and about the South.
Okay.
And this one's called A Double Wide Texas Christmas.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Double Wide is a city, the smallest city in Texas, and it only has 10 residents. And they found out that they cannot become a city unless they double their population. So they have decided to join all the cities in Texas in this manger competition. And they're going to try to become a town. And there's a lot of... we had a read-through, and nobody that auditioned for the show had ever read the show before.
Uh-huh.
And we had to it took us almost 2.5 hours to read the show because we were laughing so hard. Yeah, and the show was, like, way less than 2 hours, so.
That sounds so fun.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. Well, when is it running?
It runs – it starts on December 7th.
Okay.
And it runs for 2 weekends, 7th, 8th, and 9th.
Okay.
And then we have a Thursday performance, the 13th, 14th, 15th, and 16th.
Okay.
And our Thursday performances are $10 for everybody.
Uh-huh.
And the other performances are $15 or $10 for children 12 and under.
Mm-hmm.
And our Sundays are matinees at 2 o'clock, and our evening performances start at 7:30.
Oh, it's well. I think I have to see this. I wonder. No, it's not. That's not. It's never been made into a short story, has it?
No. There was another show called Double Wide Texas, which is the first one.
Uh huh.
And you don't have to see that to see this one, but the same characters are in that. And we're actually looking at that just to see if we want to do that one because this one's so funny.
And I love the Christmas, though. I love mm-hmm. the idea of the manger competition.
Oh, yeah. They have one of the competitions is a Star Wars theme. So it's a galaxy far, far away in a manger.
Oh, so. Lord. It sounds wonderful. Well, it sounds like one of those Hallmark things, only with a very wry, sardonic twist.
Correct. And there's raccoons that are chasing people all over the stage. And it's just there's just so much fun in the show. And I like fun. I like directing a lot of shtick. And so there's a lot of that in the show.
And who and where how large is the cast?
The cast is 12 people. One of them you never see. He's just a voiceover.
Okay.
Which he likes very much. He's our sound man that's doing it. So he's
good.
Happy with that.
Uh-huh.
And we only seat 80 in the theater. So it's definitely to make reservations is not required, but we definitely urge
advised.
It.
Mm-hmm. You, and it was Footlight the Theater that started the 50-50 raffle.
I think so, because we've been doing it forever, before I started.
Yeah.
In fact, one of our guys, I mean, he has it down to a science. It's like 10 for 20 and 20 for 30.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I that was the first. That was the, oh, our radio station is falling apart as we speak. The first time I ever encountered that. But that's a clever little way of fundraising.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we keep our half for our youth program, and we're doing one again this year. Last year we did one. And we do it so that we don't have to charge the children.
Right.
So it's open to everybody if they can afford it or not.
That's great.
And we had 21 last year in our summer program, and they loved it.
Great. All right. Well, Rob, it's nice to meet you. And I am so happy to hear about a double-wide Texas Christmas.
Thank you very
good
much.
Luck with the show. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear this conversation and previous conversations of Eye on the Arts on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And tune in next Monday here on Regionally Speaking for another Eye on the Arts conversation on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much. Back with you tomorrow.